Hi, welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This month is all about science. Let's hear from Dave Barry as he helps young scientists and their families negotiate science fair projects in Weird Science, found in the book Dave Barry is Not Taking the Sitting Down, published in 2000. Today's topic for young people is how to do a science fair project. So, your school is having a science fair. Great! The science fair has long been a favorite educational tool in the American school system, and for a good reason. Your teachers hate you. Ha ha! No, seriously, although a science fair can seem like a big pain, it can help you understand important scientific principles, such as Newton's first law of inertia, which states, a body at rest will remain at rest until 8:45 p.m., the night before the science fair project is due, at which point the body will come rushing to the body's parents, who are already in their pajamas, and shout, "I just remembered the science fair tomorrow, and we gotta go to the store right now!" Being driven to the store by pajama-wearing parents at the last minute is the most important part of any science fair project, because your project, to be legal, must have an official science fair display board. This is a big white board that you fold into three sections, thus giving it the stability that it needs to collapse instantly when approached by humans. The international scientific community does not recognize any scientific discovery that does not have an official science fair display board teetering behind it. Many top scientists fail to win the Nobel Prize for exactly this reason. Once you have returned home and gotten your display board folded into three sections, allow about 6 hours for this, it's time to start thinking about what kind of project to do. The prize-winning projects are the ones that clearly yet imaginatively demonstrate an interesting scientific principle. So you can forget about winning a prize. What you need is a project that can be done at 1 a.m. using materials found in your house, ideally. It should also involve a minimum of property damage or death, which is why, on the advice of this newspaper's legal counsel, we are not going to discuss some of our popular project topics from previous years, such as what is inside plumbing and flame-proofing your cat. Whatever topic you select, your project should be divided into three parts. One, the hypothesis. Two, the part that goes after the hypothesis. And three, the conclusion. This should always be the same as the hypothesis. The hypothesis, which comes from the Greek words hypot, meaning word, and hesis, meaning that I am looking up in the dictionary right now, is defined as an unproved theory, proposition, supposition, etc., tentatively accepted to explain certain facts. For example, a good hypothesis for your science fair project might be, there is a lot of gravity around. You could prove this via an experiment in which you pick up various household items, such as underwear, small appliances, siblings, etc., and observe what happens when you let go of them. Your conclusion would, of course, be there is a lot of gravity around. This would be dramatically illustrated in your science fair exhibit by the fact that your official science fair display board was lying face down on the floor. If that project sounds like too much effort, you might consider duplicating the one that my wife swears she did in the 7th grade late on the night before the science fair. It was called Waves, and it consisted entirely of a baking pan filled with water and a pencil. You swished the pencil around in the water and it made waves, my wife explained. I asked her what scientific principle this project demonstrated, and after thinking about it for a moment, she answered, "The movement of water." Impossible though it may sound, I did a project in 6th grade that was even lamer than that. It was called Phases of the Moon, and it consisted of a small rubber ball that I had darkened half of by scribbling on it with a pen. You were supposed to rotate the ball, thus demonstrating scientifically that the phases of the moon were caused by, I don't know, ink. The total elapsed time involved in conceiving of and constructing this project was maybe 10 minutes, of which at least 9 were devoted to scribbling. But it still might have been a success had it not been for the fact that some of my fellow students found it amusing to snatch up the moon and throw it, so that it became sort of a gypsy exhibit, traveling around the Harold C. Crittenden Jr. High School gymnasium, landing in and becoming part of other projects, helping to demonstrate magnetism, photosynthesis, etc. So my project ended up being just a sign saying, "Phases of the Moon," setting on an otherwise bare, naked table, the scientific implication being that the moon is a very moody celestial body that sometimes just gets in a phase where it takes off without telling anybody. Of course, if you want to get a good grade, you have to do a project that will impress your teachers. Here is a proven winner. Hypothesis that, parentheses, name of teacher, and, parentheses, name of another teacher, would prefer that I do not distribute the photo I took of them when they were chaperoning our class trip to Epcot Center and they ducked behind the cottage cheese exhibit in the amazing world of curds. Depending on the quality of your research, you might get more than a good grade from your teachers. You might get actual money. Yes, science truly can be rewarding. So why wait until the last minute to start your science fair project? Why not get started immediately on exploring the amazing world of science, without which we would not have modern technology, television, for example? Let's turn it on right now. Next, we'll tackle Gravity in Great Moments in Science by Dave Barry, printed in the Miami Herald October 1st, 2012, and originally published March 16th, 1997. Settle back, because today I'm going to tell you the dramatic true story of what happened when some Japanese researchers decided to recreate the historic discovery of the law of gravity. As you recall, this discovery occurred in an English orchard in 1666 when, according to legend, Isaac Newton, the brilliant mathematician, fell out of a tree and landed on an apple. Upon reviewing the videotape, I see that, in fact, the apple fell out of the tree and landed on Newton. Had this occurred today, of course, Newton would have simply put on a foam neck brace and sued everybody within a radius of 125 miles. But those were primitive times, and Newton was forced to settle for discovering the law of gravity, which states, a dropped object will fall with an acceleration of 32 feet per second, and if it is your wallet, it will make every effort to land in a public toilet. Later on, Newton also invented calculus, which is defined as the branch of mathematics that is so scary it causes everybody to stop studying mathematics. That's the whole point of calculus. At colleges and universities, on the first day of calculus class, the professors go to the board and write huge, incomprehensible equations that they make up right on the spot, knowing that this will cause all the students to drop the course and never return to the mathematics building again. This frees the professors to spend the rest of the semester playing cards and regaling one another with hilarious stories about the mathematical symbols they've invented over the years. Hey, remember the time Professor Hinkwaddle drew a cosine derivative that was actually a picture of a squid? Yes, Newton made many contributions to science, but gravity was definitely his biggest. That's why a group of Japanese researchers decided, as an international goodwill project, to recreate the original discovery using an apple tree that was descended from the original Newton tree. I found out about this project thanks to an alert reader named Harley Ferguson, who sent me a story about it from an English-language Japanese newspaper called the Daily Yomiuri. The article states that in August 1996, researchers at the Construction Ministry's Public Works Research Institute in Arai, Japan, received a sapling descended from the original Newton tree. This sapling, according to the story, came from the U.S. Commerce Department's National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, which is in charge of weights and measures. So if your pants don't fit the way they used to, this is the agency to complain to. I was curious as to why a U.S. government agency would be providing Newton saplings, so I called NIST and spoke with the official archivist, whose name is Karma Abiel. She sent me a bunch of information, which I will attempt to summarize here. The original Newton tree, for simplicity's sake, let's call it Bob, died in 1814, but before Bob went to the big orchard in the sky, cuttings were taken, and over the years, these cuttings became trees, and the cuttings were taken from those. And so now, there are genetically identical offspring, let's call them boblets, all over the world. One boblet lives at the NIST facility in Gaithersburg, Maryland. It produces apples, but not many. The information Karma Beale sent me refers to the tree as, I am not making any of this up, a very shy fruiter. The story gets a little murky at this point, but apparently the sapling sent to Japan for the historic recreation of Newton's discovery was grown from a seed from one of the NIST boblet apples. This is significant because if the sapling came from a seed as opposed to a cutting, it is probably not a pure Bob descendant. As the NIST documentation states, the original flower was almost certainly pollinated by some other tree. Trees are total sluts this way. But let's not be picky. The important thing is that the Japanese researchers had a sapling that was in some way connected to the original historic Bob. According to the Daily Yomiuri, their plan was to videotape the exact moment when the very first apple fell. The sapling was planted, and eventually it produced a single apple. The researchers set up a video camera. All was in readiness as day by day, the apple grew riper and riper, getting closer and closer to the big moment. And then, finally, it happened. A local resident who knew nothing about any of this wandered by, saw the apple, and ate it. So the researchers never did get to videotape the apple falling in a historic manner, although the article states that they did get scenes of the man munching on the apple. The man is quoted as saying, "It just tasted really bad." But this does not mean the project was a waste of time. Often in science, so-called failures produce the greatest discoveries. And this project resulted in a discovery whose value to humanity cannot be overemphasized. I refer, of course, to the fact that Shy Fruiter and the Saplings would be a great name for a rock band. Dave Barry continues to skew our perceptions of science in his book, Dave Barry's Bad Habits, a 100% fact-free book, published in 1987. I'll be reading from the section Scientific Stuff. Boredom on the Wing. Everybody should know something about birds, because birds are everywhere. Zoologists tell us there are over 23,985,409,723,098,050,744,885,145,143 birds in the city of Lincoln, Nebraska alone, which is one of the many reasons not to go there. Now, perhaps you get a bit nervous when you think about all those birds out there. Perhaps you remember Alfred Hitchcock's famous movie, The Birds, in which several million birds got together one afternoon and decided to peck a number of Californians to death. Well, you needn't worry. First, any animal that attacks Californians is a friend of man. And second, The Birds was just a movie. In real life, your chances of being pecked to death by birds are no greater than your chances of finding a polite clerk at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. There is an incredible range of birds, from the ostrich, which weighs up to 600 pounds and stands up to 9 feet tall and can run 200 miles an hour and crush a man's head as if it were a ping pong ball, to the tiny bee hummingbird, which is a mere 6 0.17 decahedrons long and can fly right into your ear and hum its tiny wings so hard you think your brain is going to vibrate into jelly and you will eventually go insane. Birds, like most mammals, especially lawyers, evolved from reptiles. The first bird appeared millions of years ago, during the Jurassic period, which gets its name from the fact that it was a fairly Jurassic period. What happened was this reptile, inspired by some mysterious, wondrous inspiration to evolve, climbed up a Jurassic period tree and leaped from the topmost branch and thudded into the ground at 130 miles an hour. Then other reptiles, inspired by the same urge as the first reptile, but even stupider, climbed up and began leaping from the branch. Soon the ground trembled with the thud of many reptile bodies, raining down on the Jurassic plain like some kind of scaly hailstorm. This went on for a few thousand years, until one of the reptiles evolved some feathers and discovered it could fly. As it soared skyward, the other species, who had grown very tired of being pelted by reptile bodies, let out a mighty cheer, which stopped a few seconds later when they were pelted by the first bird droppings. Soon birds had spread to the four corners of the earth, which is where they are today. And wherever there are birds, there are also bird watchers, in case the birds decide to try something. Bird watchers are known technically as bird watchers, which comes from the Latin word for ornithologist. Bird watchers divide birds into four main groups. Boring little brownish birds, they're all over the place. Wrens, chickadees, sparrows, nutcrackers, spanners, catcalls, dog birds, hamster birds, finches. Birds that can lift really heavy things, such as your car, albatrosses, winces, pterodactyls, unusually large chickadees, elephant birds, emus. Birds with names that you are going to think I made up, but I didn't. Boobies, frigate birds, nightjars, frogmouths, owl birds. And birds that make those jungle noises you always hear during night scenes in jungle movies. Parrots, cockatoos, pomegranates, macadams, cashews, bats. Your avid bird watchers spend lots of time creeping around with binoculars, trying to identify new and unusual birds. The trouble is, most birds are of the little and brownish variety, all of which look exactly alike and all of which are boring. So, what bird watchers do is make things up. If you've ever spent any time at all with bird watchers, you've probably noticed that every now and then they'll whirl around for no apparent reason and claim they've just seen some obscure tiny bird roughly 6,500 feet away. They'll even claim they can tell whether it was male or female, which in fact you can't tell about birds even when they're very close, what with all the feathers and everything. I advise you to do what most people do when confronted with bird watchers, which is, just humor them. If their lives are so dull and drab that they want to fill them with imaginary birds, why stand in the way? Here's how you should handle it. Bird watcher. Did you see that? You. What? Bird watcher. Over there, by that mountain. He gestures to a mountain in the next state. It's a male Malaysian sand-dredging cornet. Very, very rare in these parts. You. Ah, yes, I see it. Bird watcher. You do? You. Certainly. It's just to the left of that female European furloughed pumpkin head. See it? Bird watcher. Yes, of course I see it. You. Look, they're playing backgammon. Bird watcher. So they are. If you have a good imagination, you may come to really enjoy the birdwatching game, in which case you should join a birdwatching group. These groups meet regularly, and usually after a few minutes, they're detecting obscure birds on the surface of Saturn. It's a peck of fun. Next, what's alien you? I don't want to alarm anybody, but there is an excellent chance that the Earth will be destroyed in the next several days. Congress is thinking about eliminating a federal program under which scientists broadcast signals to alien beings. This would be a large mistake. Alien beings have atomic blaster death cannons. You cannot cut off their federal programs as if they were merely poor people. I realize that some of you may not believe that alien beings exist, But how else can you explain the many unexplained phenomena that people are always citing, such as lightning and flying saucers? Oh, I know the authorities claim these sightings are actually caused by weather balloons, but that is a bucket of manure if I ever heard one. That's just a figure of speech, of course. I realize that manure is silent. Answer this question honestly. Have you, or has any member of your immediate family ever seen a weather balloon? Of course not. Nobody has. Yet if these so-called authorities were telling the truth, the skies over America would be dark with weather balloons. Commercial aviation would be impossible. Nevertheless, the authorities trot out this tired old explanation, or an even stupider one, every time a flying saucer is sighted. New York. Authorities say that the gigantic, luminous object flying at tremendous speeds in the skies of Manhattan last night, which was reported by more than 7 million people, including the mayor, a Supreme Court justice, several bishops, and thousands of airline pilots, brain surgeons, and certified public accountants, was simply an unusual air mass inversion. That's all it was, an air mass inversion, said the authorities in Union. Asked why the people also reported seeing the words, "We are alien beings who come in peace with cures for all your major diseases and a carburetor that gets 450 miles per gallon highway estimate," written on the side of the object in letters over 300 feet tall. The authorities replied, "Well, it could also have been a weather balloon." Wake up, America! There are no weather balloons! Those are alien beings. They are all around us. I'm sure most of you have seen the movie E.T., which is the story of an alien who almost dies when he falls into the clutches of the American medical care establishment, but is saved by pre-adolescent boys. Everybody believes that the alien is a fake, a triumph of special effects. But watch the movie closely next time. The alien is real. The boys are fakes. Real pre-adolescent boys would have beaten the alien to death with rocks. Yes, aliens do exist. And high government officials know they exist, but have been keeping this knowledge top secret. Here is the untold story. Years ago, when the alien broadcast program began, government scientists decided to broadcast a message that would be simple, yet would convey a sense of love, universal peace, and brotherhood. Have a nice day. They broadcast this message over and over, day after day, year after year, until one day they got an answer. Dear Earth persons, okay. We are having a nice day. We also have a number of extremely sophisticated weapons, and unless you start broadcasting something more interesting, we will reduce your planet to a very warm object the size of a child's bowling ball. Regards, the aliens. So the scientists, desperate for something that would interest the aliens, broadcast an episode of I Love Lucy. And the aliens loved it. They demanded more. And soon they were getting all three major networks, and the Earth was saved. There is only one problem. The aliens have terrible taste. They love game shows, soap operas, Howard Cosell, and Dallas. Whenever a network tries to take one of these shows off the air, the aliens threaten to vaporize the planet. This is why you and all your friends think television is so awful. It isn't designed to please you. It's designed to please creatures from another galaxy. You know the Whisk commercial? The one with the ring around the collar, the one that is so spectacularly stupid that it makes you wonder why anybody would dream of buying the product? Well, the aliens love that commercial. We all owe a great debt of gratitude to the people who make Whisk. They have not sold a single bottle of Whisk in 14 years, but they have saved the Earth. Very few people know any of this. Needless to say, the Congress has no idea what is going on. Most congressmen are incapable of eating breakfast without the help of several aides, so we can hardly expect them to understand a serious threat from outer space. But if they go ahead with their plan to cancel the alien broadcast program and the aliens miss the next episode of General Hospital, what do you think will happen? Think about it. Have a nice day. Next up, bring back Carl's plaque. I say we put Carl Sagan into a rocket and send him out to retrieve Pioneer 10 before we all get killed. For those of you beer-swilling similiterates who don't know what I'm talking about, let me explain. The Pioneer 10 is a space probe that recently left the solar system, and Carl Sagan is a famous science personality who goes on public television and earns big buckaroos explaining the universe. Carl's technique is to use the word billion a lot. It's written into his contract that he gets to say billion an average of twice per sentence, so the viewers won't forget what a deep thinker he is. Carl will pick up a golf ball and he'll say, "To most of you, this golf ball is a mere golf ball, but it actually contains a billion, 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 billion tiny particles. If each of these particles were the size of a grapefruit, my hand would have to be a billion, 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 billion times the size of the Houston Astrodome to hold them all." This should give you a rough idea of the kind of heavy thinking I'm doing all day while you're trying to decide whether to have spaghetti or tuna surprise. Billion, billion, billion. Good night. People listen to Carl prattling on this way, and they naturally conclude he's some kind of major genius. That's what got us into this space probe trouble that's going to get us all killed. See, when they decided to send up Pioneer 10, Carl sold the government on the idea that we should attach a plaque to it so that if alien beings found it, they'd be able to locate the Earth. This is easily the stupidest idea a scientific genius ever sold to the government, surpassing even the time a bunch of scientists convinced Gerald Ford that we were going to have the legendary swine flu epidemic, which eventually had to be canceled due to a lack of actual germs. What I'm saying is that the last thing we need is alien beings. I don't know about you, but in the vast majority of the movies I've seen, the alien beings have turned out to be disgusting. A whole lot of them have tentacles, and those are the good-looking ones. Some of them are just blobs of slime. Almost all of them are toxic. So it's all well and good for Carl Sagan to talk about how neat it would be to get in touch with the aliens, but I bet he'd change his mind pronto if they actually started oozing under his front door. I bet he'd be whapping at them with his golf clubs just like the rest of us. But the really bad part is what they put on the plaque. I mean, if we're going to have a plaque, it ought to at least show the aliens what we're really like, right? Maybe a picture of people eating cheeseburgers and watching the Dukes of Hazzard. Then if the aliens found it, they'd say, "Ah, just plain folks." But no. Carl came up with this incredible science fair wimp plaque that features drawings of, you are not going to believe this, a hydrogen atom and naked people to represent the entire Earth. This is crazy. Walk the streets of any town on this planet, and the two things you will almost never see are hydrogen atoms and naked people. On top of that, the man on the plaque is clearly deranged. He's cheerfully waving his arm as if to say, "Hi, look at me, I'm naked as a jaybird." The woman is not waving because she's obviously embarrassed. She wishes she'd never let the man talk her into posing naked for this plaque. So that's it, gang. That's the plaque that's supposed to tell the aliens what you're like. Now, if Pioneer 10 is picked up, I figure it will be picked up by some kind of intergalactic police. The alien equivalent of rural police officers, they'll look at it and they'll say, "Looks to me like what we got here is we got a race of hydrogen-obsessed pervert science wimps who force the women to go around naked and probably say billion a lot. I say we vaporize their planet and then ooze over to the diner for something to eat." And that will be that. Unless we send Carl out to retract the plaque, or at least explain that it represents only him and a few close friends, we can do it. A nation that can land a man on the moon can remove Carl Sagan from the solar system. I've given this a lot of thought. Billion, billion, billion. That's all we have time for today. Join me next month for That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.